Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I am very, very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please call toll-free at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me and tell me your views, please. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll also find me on the web, www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-up to each and every program. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at Avcom, where traveling safe always matters, where safe travel is a top priority and always guaranteed. Okay, tonight's topic is the history of languages. Have you ever stopped to think that the only way people communicate with one another is through language? That's really like the only way. Think about it. The only way things get done or undone is by speaking to others. And that the only way civilizations come to be is by what is understood through the spoken word. Of course, we can also write our thoughts. We all know that. Perhaps we can even develop a love for the written word along the way, but it would still involve communication based on language. This thing we call language is an indispensable vehicle we use to tell one another our intentions, our anger and frustrations, our feelings, our sorrows, worries, joys, curiosities, even our angst to the world. We also take language as the only means to communicate in the world for granted. Every single day, we take what we speak for granted. Because even if you're deaf-mute, your hand signals are still based on communicating a language that we already know. So how did all this get started? Everything has to have a point of origin. So how did it all begin? Well, here tonight is my guest to help answer some of these questions, and who's been delving in the development of language, particularly in the genre of Romance languages, for several years now as a professor of foreign languages at both the university and high school levels, Mr. Drew Cardinale. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, George. It's wonderful to be here tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome. So, Drew, where do we begin? What is the point of origin here?
That's a good question. As I was listening to the introduction, I was thinking about necessity is the mother of invention. I don't know why, but as soon as you said something about the need to communicate, there had to have been at some point in the history, whether it was pre-caveman, caveman, post-caveman, yeah, or something like that,
yes,
that needed some type of idea needed to be exchanged,
yes,
between one human being and another.
I mean, even emotions, even your basic primal grunt,
yes.
Whether it was for whatever desires you may have, whatever anger you may want to project, you know, or just about anything, it got out there by way of a means of communicating in some way. You know, it's often been said or implied that language is an awfully, awfully poor form of communication when considering the quality and amounts of thoughts and feelings that we have inside and wanting to express an idea or issue about something. I mean, Is that some kind of an agreeable thought to some degree or another?
Yes, I agree with that. With the spoken language, if that's what we're focusing on right now, it leaves a lot to be desired. There are some things that it just will not suffice to use words. And I remember a former colleague of mine telling me in our travels that about 80 to 90% of all language is nonverbal.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought to myself, am I going to lose my job?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can have a look, you can have a gesture, you can throw out a middle finger, or what many people call the royal finger. And there are so many ways to bring that across. Absolutely. And when we come to speak about expressing a thought, that's probably one of the last weapons in our arsenal to project or communicate something to someone else. Absolutely.
In my daily work, I get people to try to express themselves verbally in another language.
Yeah.
But the way I communicate a lot of what, whether now I wouldn't say anger, but other types of emotions or whatnot, doesn't really happen with words. It happens with not only facial expressions, but with eyes as well.
Yeah, even we still throw out grunts, don't we? I mean, when we are wanting to express displeasure to some degree or another, you know, we can grunt. Right. It's okay to grunt.
Even with the body positioning,
yes,
one can, whether one is in front of a lot of people or one is individually with someone else, the way that one positions one's body, as even without being addressed, I could be talking to someone and they could have their arms crossed. They could be using their eyes not to make eye contact.
Yes, absolutely.
And all of that even communicates so much more than what they could be saying.
Absolutely.
They made a choice to say nothing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've seen it, and we see that every single day, and we take it for granted. We take it for granted, and we see it every single day. You know, you really bring out a really good point, because you just reminded me of what happens many times, even in things that we watch occasionally, such as, for example, a political debate. We saw it last time with Romney and Obama.
Yes.
Body language.
Yes.
Drew, body language. It's out there, and people see it. They cross their arms. They shift in one position in their chairs to another, right. Or they do other. What else could they do in body language that really throws out a very cogent signal that, you know, yeah, I'm very relaxed with you, or I'm really not relaxed with you,
right.
And I'm crossing my arms because I want to block you out,
right.
Or because I'm feeling very insecure about what you're saying,
right.
Or I don't really know what I'm saying at the moment. Yeah. So what else is out there? Maybe I'm thinking a twitch of an eyebrow,
yes.
Or maybe something within your tonality.
Yes, I mean, there's not only the body postures, what one says with one's eyes, but if you do choose to enunciate and elucidate with words, how are you using those words? Are you using rising intonation? Are you strolling them out to get emphasis?
Yes, singers do this all the time. I know you know a little bit about that, but because, well, ladies and gentlemen, can I say it? Drew Cornell is or was a singer and continues to sing. So he has that talent of knowing how, that very particular talent of knowing how to turn a phrase, how to make it sound extra special and have it penetrate deep into the very soul and the very matrix of people and posit a message there. Drew, absolutely. And I remember seeing it in the political elections that we recently had. The body language is outstanding as far as all of the many things that Romney did in the first debate and how Obama responded and even reacted to that.
Right.
And compare that body language to the second round of debates and even the third, which began to really turn the tables as far as who was now reacting a little bit more defensively and so forth. So, I mean, the body language is without a doubt there more so than the actual spoken word.
Yes, and isn't it funny that I don't recall what network it was, but they had a guest come in after to analyze the body language, and they had to use it. They had to analyze it through the spoken word.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I saw it in Fox, where I don't remember what program it was in the Fox network that actually had this expert come in and say, "Okay, if you look at this film, at this, or rather, this debate, at this particular moment, how do you analyze Obama's facial features?"
Right.
Oh, my God. The person came out with at least 10 different kinds of interpretation, right, as far as what it could all mean. They did the same thing with Romney. As a matter of fact, it was only the other day when I was in one of my own classes that I had a student make an incredibly interesting presentation about the presidential debates, mm-hmm, back in 1960 between Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And it was, boy, talking about body language and talking about another language that was being spoken simultaneously, writing right alongside with the actual spoken speech of what both Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon were talking about. Mm-hmm. And one would never figure, but two languages are being spoken right at the same time, but in different directions.
Yeah.
I remember seeing Jack Kennedy being very tanned and very confident, not doing much with his hands, just casually folded as he was sitting there listening to Nixon or listening to whoever the moderator was, Keith Jackson or whoever it might have been at that time. And Nixon, when he goes up, he begins to sweat. He begins to be defensive. Mm-hmm. He begins to look at Jack Kennedy repeatedly, mm-hmm, almost as if Jack Kennedy is talking the issues and Richard Nixon is talking to Jack Kennedy.
Right.
And he's not talking about the issues. He's talking to Jack Kennedy.
Right.
You know, so you have this incredible body language that's, you know, flowing about, inundating the whole environment of the debate,
right,
as the debate goes on in its own separate agenda.
Yes.
Of whatever it was that they were talking about. And it was fascinating to see. And of course, I mean, last time I saw that debate must have been when I was just a child in elementary school. And revisiting that debate as an adult, mm-hmm, really, I mean, you look at it, talking about the essence of language per se, in whichever way it comes across or expressed, is really fascinating to see, because body language is out there.
Yes.
You know, Drew, there are so many people who get frustrated also. They get very, very frustrated very quickly in expressing an opinion because they gag at the point of telling it in the way that their feelings or emotions are telling them to, but they just can't get it out there. They can't get it out. And it almost gets to and I want to use a term that it's used in music a lot, but I think to some degree or another, it may fit. They gag at the point almost like a rising crescendo. Uh-huh. And it gets to a point where they just say, "You know what I'm trying to say, don't you? I mean, you understand what I'm trying to..." And there is the recipient on the other end saying, yeah, sure, I know what you're trying to... But, you know, the other person may or may not know.
Right.
So, and that's even at that point, under that kind of a situation, language becomes that important. Because some people just have a tremendous ease to just, you know, express themselves so eloquently or so beautifully. And others are just, "You know what I'm trying to say. I just can't say it. The words don't come." And they really don't. The words really do not hit the top step up right. there because of, I don't know, they had a brain circuitry or, I don't know, a short circuit of some kind, okay? Right. And then there are others whose thoughts flow like olive oil charm and drips perfectly into the understanding for others to follow.
Right.
Drew, how do you account for these differences in verbal abilities?
Well, I think one of the differences is confidence. If one has practiced enough and knows the language well enough to gain a command of it and all of that, all those ingredients have a good effect on whether or not the end product comes out. There are other people who are just too emotional, and they feel too much pressure to get out what they need to say.
Sounds about right,
And one trumps the other.
Yeah.
And how can you separate the emotion from the message? If you separate the emotion too much from the message, you get something that seems disinterested or detached.
Drew, do you think that some of these differences may be due to a person's education, formal education?
Yes, especially when someone gets into a situation where they may feel that they are with people who are not their equal. And they try to hold a conversation, and they can only go so far and say,
And then they feel
don't you get what I mean? Maybe another way of saying, I don't have anything else to say, or I can't, I don't have the words, I don't have, I have not equipped myself with.
Yeah, that's sort of like an ouch kind of a moment.
Correct. Depending on the company, you may be chastised or you may be pardoned. Yeah.
You may even find yourself being overwhelmed a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Drew, do you think it may also have something to do with the ability that a person may have to write?
Perhaps. If one is a speech writer, they are gifted in that way. Perhaps... to that person, it comes much more easily to write it down. When people express love for one another, sometimes they just either well up and can't produce it, and they have to take a moment to stand back and figure out what they want to say, and they find it less threatening situation to write it down.
Or sometimes they can even write it in the form of a song.
They can.
And just write lyrics about it.
That's another type of expression that which people feel comfortable. I remember thinking about Bill Clinton and how, if we're talking about politics, how Bill Clinton was always noted for pausing before he answered a question.
Yeah.
And I can understand that. I've done it myself. Because one wants to be careful with what one wants to say, and people sort of chastise that need to reflect upon what one is going to say before actually one says it. And I find it quite shocking, rather chagrin that they would chastise that very need for some people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something very, very important to consider, because if anything, when you see a person taking a pause, I see it as an act of great responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that self-restraint is the better part of manners.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find yourself pausing when asked a question that does require a certain degree of depth, a certain degree of reference, a certain degree of knowledge, a certain degree of analysis, the act of pausing to organize all of this in order to put out verbally a crisp, clear, well-understood answer, I think, is a kind of self-restraint that shows great responsibility in wanting to think out properly something that is balanced, makes sense, and perhaps may be informative or to a certain degree persuasive, depending on, of course, whatever is being asked.
Sure.
But no, yeah, I agree with you. And I don't think that that's limited to Clinton in any way. I think I've seen it in a great many people that tend to pick up that habit of answering, which I've always felt very, very comfortable in watching people do that, because I know that what I'm going to get back is not, you know, a quick emotional off the cuff remark like, oh, hey, you know, but then, right. you know, on second thought, you know, they say, oh my God, what did I just say? You know, and by the same token, I've seen people do exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
People who immediately, instantly, you know, jump out at the opportunity to let me answer first, you know, and,
right.
and for them, it doesn't become a question of substance of answer, but rather in the timing of the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, if I answer first, I'll capture first attention of
right.
my audience, you know, and so then I wonder if it's more about your ego and your need and your psychological complexes than it is about delivering mm-hmm. a kind of quality answer that elucidates, that informs comfortably many other people, whoever you're answering, and you know, it offers them a certain degree of comfort in knowing, oh, okay, that makes sense. I understand a little bit wider now, in broader terms, what it is you're trying to say. But
right.
You know, if language were truly a poor or limited way of communicating, Drew, would we as people be better off by having mental engrams surgically implanted in our brains as yet another method of telling and expressing our thoughts? I mean, I know that sounds a little bit radical, I know, but, you know, if it were a poor or limited way of communicating, are engrams the answer here? I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a little bit self-destructive at this point. I'm not sure. But please, see if you can answer this in whichever way you feel is necessary.
Well, if one were to have these mental engrams, as you say, without any control of the host, with going along with it, then we would be in big trouble. Because
yeah.
anyone could supposedly tune in to what the brain waves are.
Yeah.
Purporting, and God, who would want to read? Well, I wouldn't want my mind to be read so freely.
Against the right to privacy, Ninth Amendment.
Right, goodness gracious, I think what goes on in our head is sacred at times.
Yes.
And, although perhaps for people who do not have the ability of language, the ability of verbal language, perhaps that type of scientific approach could help us understand what the person is thinking.
Yeah.
Without picking up on the brainwaves,
right,
with
right,
that type
right.
of translation, we can
right.
that communication can be enhanced.
Right.
But certainly,
yeah, just
a
as an instant reaction. No, not really a good idea.
No. It may have its place.
May have its drawbags, a serious
as
drawbags.
Well, as well.
I had no idea you thought of me that way. Right?
No.
Honey, wait, let me explain. All right, well, on that note, let's take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with Drew Cardinal and the History of Language. Okay, let's take a quick pause here for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments. My number is toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also mention a quick word about the Valley of Avcom. Airline companies, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at AFCOM really do go out of their way to make sure all your destinations are met. What do these folks do? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order, and we know how important that can really be. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why do airlines pay attention to AFCOM? Well, AFCOM is one of the largest third-party automatic test equipment operators in Miami. We provide avionics and component repairs, defect rectifications, schedule maintenance, and overhaul modifications of avionics. They are also an FAA, EASA, and pending CAAC-approved repair facility that have been in business for over 25 years. They are an approved repair station for GMF, Air Transit, Air Wisconsin, Boeing, Comair, Delta, ExpressJet, Allegiant Airlines, KLM, Lufthansa, Monarch, Saab, SkyWest, used to be U.S. Airline, now American Airlines, Iceland Air, etc. AFCOM operates in 17 automatic test equipment systems and is an approved vendor for 95% of domestic and international carriers. They have a warranty rate also of less than 1%. Now, get a load of this. They are a one-stop avionics repair shop specializing in all three manufactured TCAS systems. In addition, they have a TCAS antenna repair program, a flat rate of $1,895, no evaluation fee, designed so you can evaluate the cost benefits of repairing versus replacement. They do repair all overhaul high-end avionics manufactured by Bendix, King, Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, ACSS, Smiths, Thales, and BAE in current production for Airbus, Boeing, Douglas, CRJ, and ERJ aircraft. They offer a superior service and the fastest turnaround time possible. They would be very, very pleased if they would allow you a quote for the next repair. So please call these folks at the local number in Miami, 305-436-0300. That's 305-436-0300. Or you can also check them out at the web. That's www.avcom-avionics.com. That's www.avcom-avionics.com.
Friday night, I'm going nowhere. All the lights are changing green to red. Turning over TV stations, situations running through my head.
Okay, and we are back with Drew Cardinale, professor of foreign languages. And Drew, I have a couple of things that I really am curious to see what your answers are to some of these questions that I have, because I am genuinely curious. I've always wanted to know some of these things, but never really had the background talking about language or lack thereof on my part. I do plead ignorant for all the right reasons. But, Drew, where does language come from? First of all, what is language and where does it come from?
I think any type of textbook definition would be along the lines of a group of symbols and sounds, without getting too complex, there are four basic components of language used to, which are, and this is a very important part of language, predictable under a rule to have communication be made intelligible and comprehensible. Language is basically divided into four parts, the morphology, the semantics, the syntax, and the morphology. All of these have to do with how all language comes to be. What do we know as modern language? All languages have these of course, nonverbal is something different. But they all have these four aspects, I should say.
You know, among the four components that you mentioned, the one that seems to stand out the most, probably because I use it in my own field as well, is semantics. Mm-hmm. There is a certain art form to using semantics, perhaps wrapping it around a certain rhetoric or a rhetorical phrase that may bring across to people a certain message that could be so polished that, you know, it may just go right over their heads. Right. You don't know. But semantics is just one of those clever uses of language that I wonder how many people just get lost in the semantics. Well, what is semantics in particular?
Semantics is what a word means, basically. Mm-hmm. And the interpretations of the meanings of words by certain people can lead to miscommunication.
Yes.
yeah. Misunderstanding. Yeah. And just... I didn't mean that. It could also be offensive.
Right, yeah, well, absolutely. I can see it happening very easily. I can also see semantics as being this somewhat camouflaged subliminal message that suddenly becomes viewed very clearly or mm-hmm. discovered through the context of what is being read in a passage. So that the context sort of like acts as a flashlight to show what the semantics really is there at the moment. I be perhaps correct
no,
in that?
Correct. Certainly, yeah. Yeah. Words don't usually happen isolated ways. That it needs good writers, good playwrights, and even good librettists.
Yeah, yeah. They tend to know how to wrap it around certain things, right? Yeah. And I think that's why a lot of people just enjoy writing and enjoy words and enjoy the study of or the love for the written word, which is, I mean, you can play with language in so many different ways, almost to the point where it can insult people because people really won't know what you're talking about,
right.
Let alone, I mean, if we throw in a really polished and artistic way of being sarcastic. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, you know, and people really won't always understand what a really sophisticated level of sarcasm could be. But anyways, I don't want to stray too far from the point, but with the idea of language, Drew, talk to us about the value of a language that I have no doubt is beautiful in its own right, but, and I hate to say this, don't get locked into the semantics here or don't get lost in any other multiple meanings behind it.
But I know what's coming.
It is locked into the morte language, locked into what has been considered by much of the world. I don't even know if that's correct. Right. Much of the world, a dead language. Right. How do you respond to something like that?
Well, it's not uncommon to think of languages as dead because just like people, languages have a life. They are born. They morph, use a more technological term.
Yeah.
But it also comes from the morphology of shape into a real language. It's used by people. It has its life, usually a very long life.
Yeah.
And sometimes because of people's death, the language dies as well. There is a romance language that has had that suffered that. I could talk about that in a moment. But I always have learned to respond to Latin as a dead language as certainly false. At worst...
Good for you.
If you were 2,000 years old, you wouldn't look the same as you did when you were 1,000 or 500 years old.
Yes, yes.
So over that course of time, you can't expect anything really to change. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if language is the official language of one of the world's smallest countries, which is the Vatican, everything is written in Latin, so that is a more conservative part. And we always think about the spoken language versus the written language. It was vulgar Latin versus classical Latin, but there's certainly more dynamism in the spoken language, and that's the thing that most is less, or I should say, is less faithful to what is written. It diverges, and sometimes that vulgar language takes a root of its own and may cause a whole new language or a dialectical difference, or it may not go very far at all.
Drew, let me ask you at this point, the Latin that was used in Catholic masses,
yes.
Would that be, based on what you just finished saying right now, vulgar Latin or classical Latin?
It's neither. It's called ecclesiastical Latin.
Ah, okay. All right. So when I recite, for example, Confidio de Omnipotente, Beata Maria Semper, Beata Giovanna Baptista, Beata, et cetera, I know I'm butchering it, but it is the academic side of the Catholic Church, be it ecclesiastics.
Correct. Ecclesiastical Latin, different. Ecclesiastical Latin differs from the classical Latin because of a couple of linguistic aspects. The word order is very different in classical Latin from ecclesiastical Latin, where we're getting closer to the Italian in the terms of pronunciation with the ecclesiastical Latin. It's not something with which people, even at the Vatican, converse. So it's, we have a great, the vulgar, the classical, and the ecclesiastical.
And the ecclesiastics. And speaking of the Vatican, by the way, maybe we have a new pope on the horizon.
Has the conclave started?
Not yet, but I would assume it's very, very close. But anyways, let me not interrupt you. But I mean, mentioning the Vatican, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, that's something that hasn't happened actually in, 600 years?
The resignation of a pope.
Yeah. And now we have this incredible development. But anyways.
Yes, they'll all be voting in Latin. They will all be, the cardinal shall come up and announce in Latin that they have a pope.
Yeah, and of course the white puff of smoke will,
come out. Non-verbal communication.
Right, exactly.
That do not speak Latin.
Right.
However, there's such a great value in Latin, even if it has changed over these two millennia. We have so many words. They say 60% of the English language comes from Latin. It's basically a cousin of Latin. So,
well, I understand that many careers are built on a Latin, the medical field.
Absolutely. There's a lot of language used.
The law field, I know for sure. Oh, my goodness. Oh, absolutely.
Botany, anyone who
studies
flowers, the lingua franca is usually Latin.
Yeah.
So even in its most conservative state, it still exists. It's that divergence of the vulgar Latin, which comes from a Latin word meaning of the people, and the classical, which is mostly written. And in any language, you're going to see a divergence between what is published, what is written, what is produced on paper as to what flies out of the mouth.
Drew, I have, I think, a very important question at this particular juncture in relation to the context of our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach a course years ago that involved the talent of doing war. The military aspect, the art form, really, I should say, of doing war. And when I first announced this course years and years ago, a lot of people started thinking, of what possible use could this course have for me?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the value in this course? Why should I take this course? And I mean, I thought vicariously in posing this question to myself, how would I, as a teacher, teach such a course?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I decided to do was to take a very old method of instruction, to take very old tenets, to take very old ideas and make them relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Make them relevant for students to use nowadays. How can students use a position of leverage to their advantage? How can they use it as a competitive edge in the corporate world after they graduate from everything that they graduate from, whatever those things may be?
Right.
How can they use the art form of doing war in a way that is relevant and very much at reach to them? And I was able to make it happen, and it became a course in great demand at the time that I taught it.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you at this point, using this as a premise and as a point to catapult into this point now regarding Latin, of what relevance is Latin to students today? How is it relevant?
Not beyond the words that we talked about in English that come from Latin, not about the, what's not only about the 90%+ of words that come into the Romance languages from Latin, it's, as you were saying this to me, I always thought about how I started the year in Latin class. I just put on the board, why Latin? And
very interesting beginning.
I got a lot of interesting responses that ran the gamut from very practical. And since a lot of students are concerned about college admission, they say it helps you with your SAT. So it's a very practical application of Latin. Not only the history of the Western Hemisphere politically has a lot to owe to the organization of the Roman Empire.
Right.
With the Senate and the common people and the Republic.
Right,
Something of the people. Architecture has a lot to owe to the language, not necessarily Latin, but the Roman Empire, of which Latin was a very big part.
Well, regarding to what you were talking about just a moment ago, as far as the classical Latin, what has that got to do formally now with the Roman Empire or with the growth of the Roman Empire?
Well,
how can you make a connection there between the two?
What you saw engraved on milestones, what you saw engraved on public buildings, what you saw engraved on tombs, all have had a common root, which was the classical Latin.
Right.
And it was basically an aid to unify the Roman Empire.
Right. Now, and of course, we've all seen these carvings on limestone and everything else. And of course, many people wonder without ever really knowing what it is. I mean, even people have become such fans of Roman language or Roman language, Latin language, is that they've even developed an incredible affinity for Roman numerals to the point where some might even write checks in Roman numerals, believe it or not.
I've not seen that, but
I have, as incredible as it may seem. but now make for us a different connection here between Latin and Romance.
Latin, as it changed over the millennia, that it was in the geographical locations that the Roman Empire conquered, have basically developed a family of languages called the Romance languages, and the Romance is very different from what one would give on Valentine's Day. This is the Romance that is an adjective based on Roma, which is the origin of this Latin language, and from when where all of this emanated.
Right.
All roads lead to Rome. All languages, all Romance languages came from that place.
Yes.
It happened over many... And I would say when the Roman Empire fell, and we're talking about 476 AD,
yes.
You know very well that Europe went into a very dark period.
Oh, yes. The Middle Ages.
It was not until, I would say, from what I remember, 900, 1000, or 1100 AD, that what they actually spoke got to be on the written paper. Because as that So let's say a type of Latin was still spoken in and around Rome, 300 AD, 400 AD.
Might something. It have developed originally perhaps as a dialect?
Not originally. It became that way.
Okay.
Because just like English, you are taught that these are sentences, you taught these are the proper words. Well, when you get out with your friends, there may be some type of influences that say, oh, right. I'm going to use this word, this is a better word, or not. They don't make these conscious decisions, but pressures from whatever may change your vocabulary, all of that. So it wasn't until the end of 900 when we saw people couldn't understand what was on the written page. So they would gloss on the right-hand side so even the monks could know what was going on. I mean, they had an idea, but there were just some things that they could not register. So what came of these glossas
right.
in Spanish and when monks in Spain, monks in the region of Strasbourg and France, you got to see, oh, this means, this is what we say, we don't say this now. And even way before that, there was this document called the Appendix Probi, which and wise man Probus had noticed, even this is 200 or 300 AD, even way earlier, said, why is this being said? You should say, this is being said, not this.
Right.
So this is when you realize that gender plays a big role in the organization of the nouns in Latin. The word for mother-in-law had masculine ending. I'm just picking this out of random. I just
right.
wanted to remember. The word for mother-in-law had a masculine ending, but someone said, why are we using this ending for something that refers to a feminine person? So they changed it.
You know, let me bring something else here to the fore, because a lot of people have said, and I really don't know if this is true or not, but that Shakespeare used to invent words. Was this a somewhat similar occurrence along with the development of Latin as a language, where people just took the example that you just brought out and said, well, why are we using this word in this form? Why don't we change it to make it appear like this and make it sound like that? I mean, was that possible or not really among the origin of Latin as a language, and have that in and of itself serve as an outgrowth to other Romance languages?
Probably because that is based on classical Latin, it's not necessarily a unique vocabulary word in and of itself.
So it is distinctly different than we're talking about. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Now, with regard to Shakespeare, I'm not well-versed in
no, neither am I.
plays,
neither am I.
But I do respect him for the contribution that he made, and I wouldn't doubt that the brilliant mind had put forth some words that are,
you know,
still used today.
I wanted to ask you very quickly about Greece and the Greek languages. I know Greek is very, very deeply set in antiquity. But let me take a quick break real quick.
Sure.
Here, let's take another quick break, and we'll be right back with Drew Cardinale and the history of language. And then we're going to delve into the antiquity of Greece. Let's take another quick pause here for our audience in case you are joining us late. If you wish to call in with questions or comments, please, the number is toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also mention a quick word about the value of AVCOM. Airline execs and airline companies, please listen up. This is to your straight interest. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and the fastest way to travel. And the folks here at AVCOM really do go out of their way to make sure
that all your destinations are met. Folks, I've been there, and they have a huge facility, and they go out of their way to do whatever they can to make flying the safest experience possible. What do these folks do in particular? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are all in proper working order. If you are on a business trip or going anyplace else, you know, I don't have to tell you how important that really is. They maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why do these airlines pay attention to AVCOM? Well, AVCOM is one of the largest third-party automatic test equipment operators in the Miami area. AVCOM is a part of 145 FAA, EASA, and CAAC approved repair facility, and they've been in business, folks, for over 25 years. Operating in 17 automatic test equipment systems, it is widely considered as one of the largest third-party ATE operators in the entire world. AVCOM provides repairs, overhauls, modifications to nearly every high-end avionics system and associated components. They have been approved avionics repair station for many of the world's airlines and MROs, Aero Turbine, AeroSail, Air Transit, Air Wisconsin, Allegiant, Aloha Air Cargo, Boeing, Capital Cargo, Comair, Delta, just to name a few, and it goes on and on, ExpressJet, GE, CAS, Iceland Air, ILFC, Kellstrom, KLM, Lufthansa, Saab, and it goes on, folks. Why use AVCOM? They offer superior customer service and the fastest turnaround time possible. With an industry-leading overall average TAT, 9 calendar days and a warranty rate of less than 1%. That's what I said, less than 1%. There's a 24-hour AOG support telephone at 305-436-0300 with current tag exchanges ready to go. This is a one-stop avionics shop. We repair current production avionics manufactured by ACSS, BAE, Bendix King, Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, Smiths, and Thales for aircraft manufactured by Airbus, Boeing, Bombardier, Douglas Embraer, and Gulfstream. They have a licensing agreement with avionics equipment manufactured, including Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, ACSS, Smiths, and Thales. They specialize in repairs to all three manufactured TCAS systems. AVCOM has a TCAS antenna repair program with a flat rate of $1,895 and a low $75 evaluation fee designed so that you can evaluate the costs, benefits of repairing versus replacement. They custom tailor schedule maintenance programs and technician training for any, that's any size operation. So please do call these folks at 305-436-0300. Call them at 305-436-0300, or please, you can check them out at the web at www.avcom-avionics.com. That's www.avcom-avionics.com. Okay, and we are back, but I'm afraid that we are almost running out of time, and as much as I would love to delve with the question of Greece, I'm afraid that we're going to have to leave that for another opportunity, and I hope that you will be back in another opportunity.
I would love to.
Because actually, some of the things I would love to touch on is the Romance languages, and unfortunately, we just didn't have enough time to do this. But I would love to know from you, Drew, what is or where is the romance in Romance languages? Okay. Or is there a connection between music and Romance languages? And these are the kinds of things that I wish we really had more time to dedicate. Or are we simply stuck with language forever? Or do you see another way to communicate other than words, song, plays, war, pantomimes?
attires, attitudes, dispositions, stares, vaudevilles, appearances, or anything else that I might have left out. All of these are different ways to communicate language, but nonetheless, the idea of having romance in language and song, that connection, that conduit is so very important to find a special moment to warm our lives and make it, if only for that moment, different and special. But I'm afraid we've come to that final part of our show, Drew, where I wish to leave you and everyone else out there, our audience, with a final thought to consider and to reflect. Language is indeed a beautiful form of expression, but it could also be just as much provocative and conflictive as it can be peaceful. It's our choice to do with it what we think is best. But if language is our predominant form of communication, that is, the one form or method we use the most to communicate, then why do we continue to have so much trouble with it? Why do we have so many problems communicating ideas and messages to one another? Is it a lack of vocabulary, a lack of structure or organization, or simply a lack of thought and disregard? The intention of peace, beauty, or conflict lurks behind our speech. And depending on the speech we use will determine the outcome we decide to live with and the consequences we will surely face. So think well before you speak, my friends, for tomorrow is promised to no one. Join me again next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. And also please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing all of you a very pleasant evening.